Okay, this morning's talk, today is Thursday, is on how to become enlightened, so please listen carefully. So far I've been mentioning about sort of getting into deep states of meditation, and today I want to explain how those deep states of meditation lead to those sorts of insights and understandings which creates the destruction of the fetters, which destroy craving, which lead to the stages of enlightenment occurring. At the same time, I wanted to bring in to play the Satipatthana, and I like to do this because sometimes I know that I've heard people say that Ajahn Brahm just teaches Samatha, he never teaches Vipassana. And I know that people who think of Vipassana always think that Vipassana equals Satipatthana. So I'm going to teach Satipatthana this morning. But the point is, as I will describe, the Satipatthana is not sort of just Vipassana. In fact, if you ever look at any of the Satipatthana suttas, the word Vipassana is not mentioned in there once. The jhana is. But the point is that, you know, all this sort of messing around the Samatha Vipassana and all that sort of stuff, that's just really by the way. The point is that if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, you see actually how the Buddha described to do Satipatthana in the suttas. Not just the two suttas in the Digha Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya, but it's also in the Sanyutta Nikaya, it's what's called the Satipatthana Sanyutta, a whole collection of short teachings of the Buddha on Satipatthana. And if you take them all together, actually you get a very good idea of what Satipatthana is, how to practice it, and also why you should practice it. And I think I've made the point earlier that any of you who have a look at that Satipatthana Sutta, you come across a number of points in the very beginning, which I'd just like to clear up just to make the preparation just thorough. First of all, there's a phrase which the Buddha says in the beginning, the ekayana ayang mago, satta visuddhiya. This is the ekayana path for the purity of beings. And many people, because they have an agenda, say ekayana means the one and only path, the sole path, this is the only way, none others. I think I mentioned to you earlier that that particular description is kept by the Buddha for the Eightfold Path. What ekayana means, as many Pali scholars have discovered, because it's used again in the 12th Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the the Chuladukka Kanda Sutta, I think, or the Mahadukka Kanda Sutta, but it's the 12th one, where it clearly means a path which has only one destination. Not the only path, but the path, if you keep on following that, don't get off the path, that it has to lead eventually to Nirvana. That's what it means. And even so, the whole focus of the Satipatthana is on the Eightfold Path, not just sort of throwing away all the other parts of the practice and just focusing on some idea of mindfulness, but bringing in each of the other factors of the Eightfold Path. And indeed, for those of you who know something about that Satipatthana Sutta, it's on the four what I call focuses of mindfulness. It's where you place, focus, put your mindfulness in order to develop deep insight. And I'll mention this in a moment or two's time, because before you focus your insight on any of these four areas, there is preparation to be done, first of all. And that preparation is important. Without preparation, then you don't get good results. In the same way, if you are painting a wall, you have to prepare that wall first of all, to sand it down, fill in the cracks, wash it of grease, and then when you paint the wall, you get a very nice job. Or, if you're doing an examination, you've got to prepare yourself first of all. You've got to read the books, do the study. If you just go into the examination hall without any preparation, you're in big trouble. The same way, if you're going to have a meeting in business, if you haven't prepared yourself, read all the documents, become accustomed with all the arguments, then you're going to lose the business deal. Preparation is important. And Satipatthana, to be able to gain the enlightenment insights, needs preparation. The preparation it needs, according to the description in the sutta, is Atapi Satima Sampajano Vinaye Loke Abhita Dhammanasang, which means, as all of you will know, means that you're energetic. The energy has to be there first of all. You can't do Satipatthana just nodding all over the place and feeling dull and sleepy. You need to be mindfulness. And Sampajana literally means Sampanya, means with wisdom, with some understanding of what you're doing and why, the purpose of it all. And as I mentioned a few days ago, the most important phrase, Vinaye Loke Abhija Dhammanasang, which even in the time of Buddhaghosa, everyone understood that to mean having already abandoned the five hindrances, which is the most important of the preparations to be able to do Satipatthana. And so it's important that you have abandoned the five hindrances first of all, then the mind has power. Having abandoned those five hindrances, then when you look at something, when you contemplate it, you can contemplate it with great depth and with great clarity. Hopefully you've already experienced this sometimes during this meditation retreat, when you've got into a deeper state of meditation than is your usual accomplishment. And when you get into a deep state of meditation, when you go outside and look at the trees or feel the wind, everything seems to be so bright and so clear. Everything is polished and shining and brilliant. This is what happens of nature when the five hindrances start to subside. And if the five hindrances go completely, everything seems to be so clear and bright. One of the first meditation retreats which I did when I was still a lay person, because it was in a very confined space, we didn't have a nice garden like this to walk out in, the teacher there said that we could go for a walk for 1 hour every morning, just before breakfast. And I knew the area, and so I went straight to the botanical gardens, which was very close by, to have a nice walk in the beautiful park. For those 9 days, I never got past the entranceway, because as soon as I went into those botanical gardens, there was a clump of bamboo by the entrance. And the very first day it caught my attention. I ended up just standing there, just watching that clump of bamboo for about 40 minutes. It was about a 10-minute walk there and a 10-minute walk back. I only had an hour. And for 9 days straight, sort of I was just watching that clump of bamboo and just enjoying every moment of it. And I never finished with that clump of bamboo, just its texture, its colours, the way it was waving in the wind. It was actually captivating. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. I'd been to those botanical gardens before as a student, but never noticed anything, because your mind was so busy doing other things. The mind was obsessed with the five hindrances, it couldn't see anything. But there, watching a clump of bamboo, it was the experience of that clump of bamboo just opening itself up to me, becoming so wonderful and so beautiful and so captivating. I saw so much happiness and beauty that I couldn't take my eyes off it for a good 40 minutes. I had to drag myself away because I had to be back for the meditation. That gave me some understanding on reflection later on, what this opening of insight really is. And you do experience this through deep states of calm and stillness. In other words, when the five hindrances start to be suppressed, things start to appear beautiful. You start to see much deeper into things. The mind becomes clear. It is like just having a windscreen on your car which has been mucky and dirty ever since you were born, and finally you clean it up. And yet you see the world with sparkle rather than grey and grimy and depressing and dull. This is the nature of the mind when the five hindrances start to disappear. If the five hindrances are completely gone, then everything is brilliant and bright. It was a common experience for monks that when you start meditating like this, you start to see beauty in the most unexpected places. One of the other stories which I give is like doing walking meditation, one range retreat in our monastery in Thailand. Because it was wet and rainy, we'd all do walking meditation in the hall. The hall did not have carpet, it was concrete. And it was concrete laid by the villagers, so it wasn't either flat nor was very even. But as we were doing the walking meditation, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, I was looking at 2 meters in front of you, as you're supposed to do with mindfulness on the feet. I was walking backwards and forwards, and I had to stop because the concrete started to look so beautiful. I'd never seen so concrete so wonderful before. It was just like some painting I would have seen in the National Gallery in London. It was terrific. The colours in there and the shapes started to open up, and it was marvellous. I couldn't take my eyes off it. Wow, look at this. And to think I've been walking over this work of art for days and months and years and never noticed what was going on in this beautiful lump of concrete. This lump of concrete should be saved and sent to the National Gallery in Bangkok in Thailand to be put up on the wall. It's marvellous. That's the sort of thing which was happening. And of course at the time, you know, you didn't exactly know why or what was occurring. All you did was, wow, this is great. And afterwards, you know, when the mind closed up again and you couldn't see that beauty in the concrete anymore because the 5 hindrances had just returned, you always remembered those experiences. What was going on there and why? And it was because the ordinary mind, when you're sort of going backwards and forwards in life, is so dull, so cloudy, so full of things like sensory desire, that it's never looking where it is. It's always looking over there somewhere for the next pleasure, the next delight. Or it's so full of ill will, it just cannot look at this. This is hopeless, this is horrible. The fault-finding mind can never stay long enough with anything. It always wants to get rid of things and move on. Or it's so dull or so restless, or it's full of doubt, you're never quiet enough for long enough to allow things to happen. When those 5 hindrances are there, you just can't do these things. When those 5 hindrances are gone, it's amazing, just in a simple carpet, what you're sitting on. You can watch it, it opens up, and it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your life. The nature of the mind is like that. So much beauty just in this ordinary carpet. So what happens is you start to understand that when the 5 hindrances go, the mind can open up. Because it can see beauty, it can sustain its attention on these things for long periods of time. This is why I told many people, at this stage in the meditation, it's not advisable, this is Ajahn Brahm's teaching, to do just upeka sanya, the reflection on just equanimity. Equanimity, just concrete is just concrete. Carpet is just carpet. You want to get into it, first of all. The way to get into it is through joy. Nor is it the good thing to go thinking anicca dukkha anatta, anicca dukkha anatta. Impermanence is all suffering, non-self. It's all suffering. Meditation is suffering. Jhana is suffering. I've got to have lots of suffering. The more suffering I see, the more enlightened I get. You never can actually get into things that way, because that perception of suffering just repels you and creates a lot of restlessness where you want to go somewhere else. That's why the perception of the beautiful, which was a bona fide meditation instruction of the Buddha, the Subhasanya, he said, is the way to really overcome those 5 hindrances and to get them so that they are abandoned and you enjoy their abandoning. Everything sparkles, everything is clear. But that's really good fun. You have a lot of happiness when you go home and you say, wow, I got so deep in meditation, just and one leaf was just brilliant and marvellous, and the carpet in the meditation hall, you wouldn't believe just what I saw in that carpet. Which is great fun to tell your friends, and it's very enjoyable at the time, but it does not make you enlightened. You have the power of the mind. Your flashlight, remember that simile I gave of the mind being released from the hindrances, especially in jhana, is like a very strong flashlight. You recharge those batteries and you put a few extra batteries in there just to help, and you've got one powerful flashlight. Wherever you shine it, instead of just dull light where you only see silhouettes, you can actually see all the detail. And it's marvellous, it's fascinating. You've got a beautiful flashlight. But Shining it on trees or concrete floors or on carpets gives you a good time, but it does not make you enlightened. That's why the Buddha, in his great wisdom, said, shine your flashlight, when it's got a strong beam, on four things, the four focuses of mindfulness. When vinaya, loke, abhijja, dhammanasana, when the five hindrances are overcome, when you are a tapi, when you are full of energy, natural energy, you just can't even sleep, everything is bright, and you've got this powerful mind, satima, fully mindful, fully understanding what's going on. Then shine your flashlight on one of these four things. The four things to shine your flashlight on, your mindfulness, is the body, your body sitting here, on this thing we call vedana, usually translated as feelings, but what vedana means is the quality of happiness or pain associated with each one of the six senses, and it has a different name according to which sense. In other words, the happiness and the pain concerned with sight is called beauty and ugliness. The happiness and suffering concerning the mind is called like joy and depression. The happiness and suffering concerning, say, sound is like the terrible sound and sort of sonorous or beautiful sound. Each sense has a different word for that which has one word in Pali. That's why it's so difficult to translate. It's the quality of happiness and suffering with each one of the six senses. That's vedana. That was the second place the Buddha said, put your attention on. What is this happiness and pain business all about? The third one the Buddha said put your attention on was on the citta, on the mind. This is the most difficult one to do, unless you've got jhanas. If you haven't got jhanas, you don't know what a mind is. In fact, if you're a modern scientist, you think that the mind doesn't even exist, let alone that you can focus on it and contemplate it. Which is the mind, consciousness. The last one is on the objects of the mind, on the dhammas. Sometimes you call it on the sankharas, that which exists in the mind, the objects of the mind. And in particular, as I'll mention in a few moments, the one dhamma, the one sankhara, which is the most useful to focus your attention on, and I've talked about it a lot in this retreat already, is will, chetana, choice. Now the reason why the Buddha chose these four focuses of mindfulness is because this is where the problem lies, usually in these four areas. It's as if the Buddha was writing a manual on how to fix a car. And he said, this particular model of car, there's four places where it goes wrong. Just like, you know, the wheels, the carburetor, the gears, or maybe the, I don't know much about cars, there's another place in the car. Steering wheel or whatever. The four places, he said, this particular car, that's where the problems usually lie. So look in those four places. If it's suffering, if it's not going right, look in those four places and you'll find what's wrong there. The point is, when you look at the body, well, the Buddha actually said in the Satipatthana Sutta, he said, look at the body, contemplate it in its arising factors, its passing factors, or both, or however you contemplate it, so you can just see this is a body, that's all. That's the whole point. Purpose of this Satipatthana, to see this is just body. Enough for insight to arise that this is not my body. This is not mine. This is not a self. The whole purpose of the Satipatthana is to uproot the illusion of self. That's why it's powerful. The illusion of self, me, lives in one of these four places, mostly in the four places. a bit in each. We actually think that this is my body, that this is me. That's why when you get a pain, ow, I hurt. It's the body hurting. That's why when you get a lump somewhere in your body, you think I'm dying, and you get very afraid. That's why you look at your face and it's getting older and getting more wrinkled, and you take it personally. You think that you are getting more wrinkled, that you are becoming ugly. This is just body. It's amazing how even intelligent people will still attach to this body, so much so that when they die, they want to go through all these rites, burning it in the ceremony, also putting it in the ground. This is one place where I really prefer the Tibetan tradition. Just to say that I'm not always just a lazy Theravada. Sometimes I do acknowledge with and others. The Tibetans, they just leave the body out for the birds to peck. It's recycling. Instead of wasting all these beautiful plots of land, you know, by having graves, and wasting all this money and having all these greenhouse gases go in the air when you're cremated, just leave your body out and let the birds peck it. So it's recycled, so the birds get happy. How many of you could do that? What's wrong with that? Sometimes people say that's really ghoulish, and that's really showing no respect for the body. But hang on, I mean, this is not your body, it's just a piece of flesh. You know, before we were, some time ago, because one of the people here lived close by to the local coroner, we managed to get in to see the autopsies. So when a person was dying, you can see them all cut up. It's a great meditation object. And some people think, you're really weird. What do you want to do that for? That must be really horrible. It's not, because you're seeing the nature of your body. And the best autopsies are when it's someone your own gender, your own age, lying there. So if you see someone who looks just like you, and they're being cut open, they're dead, you poke them and you look at them, and the fellow cuts them up inside. And it really sort of rams home that their body, my body, is no difference. And so you lose sort of this attachment, identification with my body. Why do people spend so much money beautifying themselves? It's much better to be ugly. When I was a young monk, as a young boy, sort of as an accident, I fell over and I broke one of the teeth and it went all black. And when I was a young monk, some of the disciples in Bangkok said, oh, we'll take you to the doctor. I said, no, 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 no. This is my protection against pretty women. Had a beautiful black tooth in the front. So sometimes, why do people worry about their appearances and their looks? And it's stupid. So what we did is to, by contemplating this body, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self. This is just a vehicle which I use in this lifetime. You can tell whether you've really penetrated the truth of non-self in the body if you're scared of death. If you are scared of death, you've still got some more work to do. If you're still concerned about what happens to your body after you die, if you don't want to give up your organs, or just tell your relations, just a very simple coffee, and just do whatever you want with it. Bury it under a tree. So there's fertilizer there somewhere, or whatever it is. You don't really care so much about it, because this body is not sacred. It's just a body, that's all. When you look upon it this way, you stop your identification with it. You don't worry too much about it. When it gets sick and ill, you bear with it, because that's the nature of the body. When it goes, you don't go looking for another body to replace it. With the mindfulness which is generated through deep meditation, focus on this body. What is this body? As it were, in your mind's eye, you're holding up this body in front of you and allowing the mind to play in that area. And it will just see that this body, there is nothing there. The Buddha actually called it like froth on the river Ganges. It's froth, that's all. The froth takes a shape, but when you poke it, the little bubbles, they disappear. There's nothing to it. It's just an empty shell. That's why it is nice to sometimes go to an autopsy and to see this body is just made up of parts. just like a chariot in the old simile. Take it apart and it's just the wheels and the axle and all those sorts of things. There's nothing there. Only through deep meditation can you fully abandon concern for this body. When you see it's just a body, it's not me, not mine, not a self, then as it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, you live free, independent, not worrying about anything in the world. Isn't that what you want to do? But it's hard to do, unless you can abandon those five hindrances. The body opens up to you, in the same way that the carpet opens up, or the concrete opened up, and you just see this is just body, that's all, nothing there at all. And all this illusion about being a man, being a woman, being beautiful, being old, being young, being English, being Singaporean, being Asian, being tall, being short, being fit, being sick, that's just an illusion. Something which we worry about and spend so much time on. In the deep meditation, if you look on your body, that's all there is, just a body. And no more will you have any attachment to it, concern for it. You have just the same amount of concern as a rented car. It's not your car. It's amazing when people actually own a car. They spend so much time looking after it, especially if it's a new car. They even give it a name. Just like you give yourself a name, Ajahn Brahm, Nisarana, or whatever. And then we care about it, we love it, and it's our car, it's our beautiful car, we've had so much times in it, good times in it. So it's not yours, it's a rented vehicle. And when it's a rented vehicle, when the time runs out, they'll call it back in again. And you might struggle and cry and try and bargain, but it's too late. You have to give up your car. The second focus of mindfulness is even more powerful, but hard to do. To focus on Vedana, on the quality of pleasure and pain in all the six senses. What actually is it when you feel pain in the body? What is it when you feel pleasure in the body? What is it when you see a beautiful sight, or you see something which is ugly? What actually is this Vedana, this movement of joy, depression, delight, and aversion, which comes up in the mind? To be able to do this, that sometimes is so much thinking goes around pleasures and pains, that we really do need to shut up if we want to know it. This is where that simile, which I've already mentioned once this retreat, I do this simile very often in Dhammaloka. You hold up something, what is it? Now just watch your mind when you try and answer that question. You give all sorts of labels what this is. That's all old knowledge. Stick, banger, black, white at the top, round, sort of 6 inches long, 1 inch wide or whatever. You have to keep on going through all that old knowledge until you fall silent. You can't remember the names to describe this. Only then can you start to see. You go through all the old knowledge, which has just been what you've been told by others, and you start to see it afresh. In the same way, when I saw the concrete, all my old knowledge was concrete is ugly, concrete is unnatural, concrete is rotten, that's why we try and cover concrete. All the old knowledge changed. I started seeing something which I did not expect to see. That's why you have to look at something for long periods of time to see something which you didn't expect to see the new, to get insight. With the feelings, you've got to see them anew, see them in a different way. To be able to fully contemplate them means holding them in your mind for long periods of time. That's the job of the word samadhi, to sustain your attention long enough, silently, not interrupting, so that thing can teach you. So what Vedana does teach you is that it's completely out of control. You get pleasure and pain in roughly equal proportions. And you find, when you watch the arising and passing away of Vedana, pleasure and pain in the body, or in your mind, or whatever, you find that pleasure is just the gap between two moments of pain. Pain is just the gap between two moments of pleasure. Beauty is just when the ugly disappears for a while. And ugly is when the beauty disappears. Delicious taste is when the rotten taste goes. You taste something delicious for a change. You know, well, I've already told you about the food which I ate in Thailand. You know, the frog soup and all these other insects and beetles, whatever crawled, that's what you ate. I started to like those frogs. After about a year, it started to taste delicious. I couldn't believe it. Why was it that this disgusting food I started to like? After a while, you like anything, if you've got nothing to compare it with. That was a problem, because I had nothing to compare it with. It became delicious. It's the same way the person who goes to a really beautiful restaurant, 5-star restaurants, when they go to a 4-star restaurant, they can't stand it. It's disgusting food, because they're used to the 5-star. Or you go to a beautiful retreat, and then next you go to a retreat which is not quite as good as this one. And that's terrible, that's rotten, and the poor old monk who teaches it really gets a blasting. That's not his fault at all. You're just making comparisons. Happiness and pain. People are in pain a lot of the time. If the pain just gets less one day, they get pissed out. It's a little bit less. When the pain gets less, to them it's happiness. When your pain gets less, you call it happiness. That's all that happiness is. The lessening of pain. And this is when you see the relative nature, the duality of Vedana. That there's happiness and there's pain, there's pain and there's happiness. Straight away, it gives you such a powerful insight, you realize there cannot be any heaven world where you're perfectly happy forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Imagine your heaven world. What would you like? Imagine you had your favorite TV program on all the time. Imagine you had your favorite food all day, breakfast, lunch and dinner. Imagine you had the most fantastic furniture, the most wonderful companions. Even with the most wonderful companion, you get bored of them after a while. That's why I know many people had wonderful relationships, husband and wives, until one of them retired and stayed at home all day. That's true. That was so hard. They're nice when they're just there now and again. When they're there all the time, they can't stand them. Even if they're lovely people. And this is the nature of like happiness. It's happiness all the time. You couldn't stand it. You wouldn't notice it. That's why even in concentration camps, torture camps, there's still a sense of happiness there. Now, one of the powerful stories which I read in a book some years ago was of an Argentinian journalist who was imprisoned by the military junta at the time during the early 70s and tortured for a couple of years. And he wrote this book, Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number, about his experiences. Because he had a few contacts in the West who started searching for him, actually saved his life. They couldn't sort of kill him and allow him to disappear. So he was released and he told his story. One of the most fascinating parts of that story was that the most terrible thing which happened to him, what tortured him the most while he was in jail, you know, being tortured on his electronic machines and beaten and all sorts of terrible stuff. But one day, the guard gave him a letter from his wife, and he read that letter He said that was the most painful experience, because he'd been in those cells underground for so many months, being tortured, being abused. Now he'd forgotten about his life outside. Now his life outside, his wife, his family, all came back to him. He had perspective, and that almost broke him. When it's pain, 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 you've got no perspective of anything else, and you can endure. But when they showed him sort of the light which was his life before, he could not stand the darkness. If you're always in the darkness, you get used to it. It was a powerful message that, you know, the classic torture, the good guys and the bad guys. You always need the good guy there. I remember one of the bricklayers in our monastery told me that during the Second World War he was in the RAF, and just towards the end of the war, while they were going on some mission over Germany, the plane got shot and the pilot said everyone abandoned. And being sort of a young man and being very afraid, straight away he was the first to jump out. Still over enemy lines. Everyone else waited, and when they bailed out, they fell in the Allied lines. And he was the only one who got captured. He really felt stupid. But anyway, when he sort of got captured, he got captured by, you know, these German soldiers, and they wanted to get information out of him. And they said it was amazing. They did the classic good guy, bad guy. After sort of interrogating for many hours, they said, "Oh, okay, I mean, sort of, you know, even though we're at war, you know, sort of, you know, we're all Europeans together, and you're a soldier, we're a soldier, we know what it's like. It's just these, you know, politicians create all these wars." They said, "You know, it's okay now, we'll look after you." And sort of, they made him this nice English meal. You know, roast beef and potatoes and gravy and Yorkshire pudding and all that sort of stuff which Englishmen like. And he hadn't eaten for a couple of days while he'd been interrogated, and they put it in front of him. And of course, just before he put his fork in, this other German came in, whacked it off the table. "You can't eat that. Tell us all your secrets," or whatever else it was. And he said that really hurt, because, you know, that was much worse than a beating, because it showed him pleasure and then just took it away from him. And it was the change which really hurt. When you just got pleasure and it's finally taken away from you, that's what really hurts, that's painful, the change in Vedana. So when actually you contemplate Vedana, you actually find out that if you really if you really want to try and find happiness in that world, you're fighting a battle you can never win. When you got happiness, because it doesn't change. If it doesn't change, in other words, you get eternal happiness, you won't realize it's happiness anymore. Even in Christian theology, I remember reading that them saying that according to theology, that if you go to heaven, once every year you get taken down to hell for a visit. Because otherwise, you would not appreciate heaven. There would be no pleasure anymore. And even though that's a weird idea, you can see why it makes sense. If you lived in heaven all the time, you just become boring. That's why that's the nature of Vedana. The nature of Vedana is pleasure is only the gap between two moments of pain. Pain is just the gap between two moments of pleasure. So what does that teach us? It teaches we cannot hold on to pleasure. It has to go. There's no way we can keep it. It's its very nature to disappear. So if we think we're happy, be careful, it won't last. Or if you're having a terrible time, a lot of pain, mental pain, physical pain, eye pain, sort of sound pain, whatever else other pain, you know, really you're having a terrible time, don't worry, it cannot last. It's this nature to disappear. It's essential nature to disappear. So that's why, it's a famous story, I had typhus fever in hospital in Thailand about 24 years ago. I felt terrible, and it was a really awful hospital. It was a monk's ward, but this was in the Wut Buts of Thailand. It was a third world country. And I was taken in there feeling really rotten, high fever, just, you know, could hardly walk, sat in the bed. And at 6 o'clock, you know, the nurse, sort of on duty there, sort of went. And 6:30, the next nurse hadn't come yet. 7 o'clock, still hadn't come. I said, where's the next nurse coming? The night nurse. There is no night nurse. If you die at night time, that's just bad luck. There's only one shift and that was it. And I still remember this nurse who used to come and sort of inject you with antibiotics, you know, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. And there's no such thing as disposable needles in those days. They sort of, you know, they kept on boiling the needles again and again. And the needles which were finished in Bangkok, they sent up to the provinces, and that's what you got. And they were so blunt. And after a while, whenever I saw that nurse coming, I just really, my jaw dropped. Oh, not again. Because, you know, she had to inject you in your backside, and it really hurts. Whack. You're already feeling quite sick anyway. While I was in that, while you were in that sort of that hospital, feeling really rotten, Ajahn Chah came to visit. And you know, that's your teacher, this great monk, and you felt so flattered, you felt so wonderful. That really sort of, you know, made my day for a couple of minutes until he opened his mouth. Because you know, many of you heard what he said. He said, yeah, so if you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. That's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear, how are you doing? Hope you get well soon. And all that sort of stuff. Instead he said, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. It was true. Because that's what happens in hospital. Either you get better or you die. But either way, the pain doesn't last. So what he was actually teaching me was anicca. But Vedana does not last. And if I could only have understood that at the time, I'd have had a much better experience in hospital. Because you know, however bad it feels, it cannot last. Because the very nature of Vedana, what that means is you do not attach anymore to Vedana. What attaching to Vedana means is, if it's pleasure, okay, it's pleasure, it's going to go. If it's pain, okay, it's pain, it's going to go. This is the nature of life. I haven't made a mistake. Someone else hasn't made a mistake. Don't blame your husband for all your bad Vedana. I'm hurting, it must be his fault. Or I'm having a terrible time, it must be your fault. This is the nature of Vedana. Don't think it's because you're not exercising, you're not eating the right food. Even people who eat brown rice and do yoga, they get bad backs and they get cancers and they die. Doesn't matter what you do. Sickness is our nature. When we understand that, we don't get so bothered with pains. We can actually bear them much more because we don't think something's wrong. Something's right. It's a nature. We can detach. Also, as well as seeing that this is not mine, this is nature, we see that this is not a self. It's not me who is feeling pain. It is just pain. If you can look upon pain as being just like that, not me, not mine, not a self, then pain does not blow you around so much. It's because we've always been taught, we've always been assumed, we've got conditioned. When this hurts, there's always an I on the end of it. I hurt. I'm depressed. I am in pain. That is the problem. If you can take Vedana and just watch it, just like I said to watch a stick, this is pain. What is it? Instead of saying, ow, ow, I don't want it. I don't want to look at it. Look at it. Get hold of it. Watch it. Until all of those old words, I don't like this, this hurts, this is going to kill me, how long do I have to do this for? Shut up. Until you just see pain as you've never seen it before. Until you can actually delve into it. And see what it is. And see it's just the nature of the senses. That's all it is. And then you'll never put the sense of self on that pain anymore. Then you won't be so concerned about pleasures and pains in the world. The pleasures won't entice you, the pains won't destroy you. You'll be free. One of my, just to be ecumenical again today, I'm in my ecumenical mood, I've always already praised the Tibetans. One of my favourite people in history was St. Bernard, a good old Catholic. The sort of Catholics I like were the ones who got in big trouble. And he... he got in the usual big trouble, ended up being burnt at the stake. That's what happened to good Catholics in those days. And being burnt at the stake. Now, how many of you have ever burnt your fingers or your hand? How much it hurts? Apparently, people say that the pain of burning or is one of the worst pains in the body. Imagine having your whole body burnt, alive, with everyone watching. This St. Bernard, this is a monk, he was great, because his last words, recorded in history, when he was charred, and you know, you have all these boils coming up out of your body as you're burning alive, most of his body blackened, obviously in great pain, just before he lost consciousness, his last words were in Latin, but translated into English were, "Turn me over, this side's done." That's what I call a monk. That's great, because not only was he above pain, but two, he had compassion, because he saw all these other miserable people watching him, and he cracked a joke. Now that's what I call a good monk. So I mean, I just like a piece of toast. And it's true, ask any Catholic, that's very St. Bernard. Or it could be St. Lawrence, one of the two. Anyway, that just shows what you can do if you detach from pain. Great, isn't it? So that's when you do the focusing on pain. Not only pain, but beauty and ugliness. Why is somebody beautiful and another person ugly? Why is it when you fall in love, the person you marry is very beautiful, 2 years later they're ugly, you wonder what you ever saw in them? Have they really changed? Or has your mind changed? You see so much of pain, so much of beauty, so much of, you know, deliciousness in your food. It's so much just what we add into it. That's all it is. Just another story, I told it so many times, but it really fits in now. One of the other characters in our monastery got very bad teeth, and he gets fed up. It's a long way from Perth, from our monastery into Perth. And the only place he could go to find a dentist where they take out his teeth without anaesthetic, because he didn't like anaesthetic, it was a waste of time. He just wanted the dentist just to take his teeth out straight away. And the only place was in the Perth dental clinic. And the doctor there got to know him, so that's you again, and sort of knew that he could have his teeth taken out without anaesthetic. Could you do that? Could you do what he did next? Because he got fed up with going into town, so he took his own teeth out. And we saw this, because someone saw him at the workshop with a pair of pliers in the workshop with his bloody tooth in the claws of the pliers. And we asked him, how did you do that? And this is what he said, which is a good teaching about pain. He said, when I walked to the workshop to get the pliers, the tooth didn't hurt. When I picked up the pliers and put them in my hand, the tooth didn't hurt. When I put the pliers on my tooth, it still didn't hurt. When I wiggled it around for about 2 seconds, it hurt then. But afterwards it didn't hurt. It was only 2 seconds of pain. What's the big deal? And I tell people, if that was you, even if you were walking to the workshop, it would hurt like hell. Even before you'd done anything, it would still hurt. It's the fear which makes it hurt, isn't it? That's why when I was telling that story, a few of you were making these terrible faces, grimacing. Ugh, that must be terrible. It's only the thought about it makes it hurt. That's the problem. A lot of Vedana, pleasure and pain, is what we add on to it. It's not what's actually there. So be careful when you have pain or pleasure, if you can get into a deep meditation, you unfortunately need to get into deep meditation first of all before you can do these sorts of things. Until the mind is very clear, so it is shining, and you see things not as they're painted to be, but as they truly are, you can watch pain, and you can get through it and get beyond it, and see it for what it truly is. Impermanent, not me, not mine, nothing to do with me. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to be equanimous towards pleasure and pain? You'll be free then. But most people, they want to be equanimous towards pain, but still keep their pleasure. You can't do that. The two are intimately connected. You give up one, you have to give up the other. People want to give up pain, but they want to keep the pleasure. That's the problem. So this is an area of life, the Buddha said, put your focus of attention on. That's Satipatthana. The third focus of mindfulness is on the mind, the citta. That is a powerful place, because of all the things which we hold on to and attach as being me and essentially myself, it is that which knows. Do you really think that it's you who've been listening to all these talks, experiencing all these feelings, thinking all these wonderful thoughts and terrible thoughts, seeing all these sights for the last 9 days? What knows? What is this mind? Again, the reason why I keep on saying you need jhanas to become enlightened is because if you don't have a jhana, you haven't got a clue what this mind is. You might think, you might listen to Ajahn Brahm and have some sort of ideas, but it's not the same as actually knowing it. The mind is covered up with the 5 other senses. Just like the tadpole in the lake, the only time it can know what dry land is when there's no water around is when it grows big enough and leaves the pond. You cannot know water or wetness when you're still in the pond. You cannot know the mind released from the 5 senses when you're still immersed in those 5 senses. It's just a mystery to you. Monks can come along just like old frogs come along and tell that tadpole, you know, this dry land, it's really beautiful, it's wonderful. And sometimes people don't believe it, or sometimes say, well, yeah, it's all right for you frogs, you were probably born on dry land. As for us tadpoles, there's no way that we could become in those high states of dry land. I haven't got enough good karma to get onto dry land. Whatever else you think, you say, I can't get into jhana. Well, the tadpoles think, I've been trying for 7 days now to get onto dry land. I haven't managed it yet, so the tadpole thinks it's never going to get to dry land. It is the nature of the tadpole to grow into a frog. It is the nature of you to get jhanas. It's only a matter of time. Maybe next life. But one day. The point is that one day you will. And once you get into those jhanas, you see the mind, you see the citta. Then, putting that mind in front of you and focusing on it, understanding what citta is, not with thinking, but with the ability to hold the attention, just like on the stick, and understand what it truly is. What is knowing? What you'll find is that knowing is just a series of blips. Between the blips, there is nothing. You find out there's times when there's not a knowing at all, that knowing arises and passes away. Knowing, otherwise called consciousness, that which knows, cannot be a self, cannot be you. It's not essential, because sometimes it's there, sometimes it goes. Once you realize that consciousness does go, the idea of the cessation of consciousness, the full turning off of consciousness, becomes not a dull and dreary and bleak idea, but something which is very attractive. The idea of nibbana sometimes at this stage becomes understood and highly acceptable. Because you never think that you are the one who knows. That's a hard one to get to people. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is the fourth focus of mindfulness is focusing on mind objects. Those include thoughts. How many of you think it's your thoughts, my thoughts, and that's why you value them so much? Do you have had any really good thoughts on this retreat? Some wonderful thoughts? The true answer is no. There is no such thing as a wonderful thought. They all sort of tend to hide reality. If you look at thoughts, thinking, you find they're all conditioned. They don't teach you anything. They're just repeating of ideas you've got from somewhere else. You know, with philosophy, I was reading a book on the history of philosophy up to 10 years ago. And the philosophy is finally going to a dead end at the moment, because according to all their theories, all they've proved is there's no such thing as truth. In other words, you can't find out what the truth is anyway, not through thinking. And the Buddha could have told them that 2,500 years ago, and they wouldn't have wasted so much time and so much Panadol and aspirin. That's what happens when you think so much. You ever seen that statue in the west of Rodin's thinker? That's right, his head is so heavy, he needs to prop it up. You ever seen the Buddha behind me? His head is so light, he can sit very straight. He doesn't need to hold his head up. That's the difference. So if you actually watch thinking, so stand back with Satipatthana, focus on that mind object, you'll find that all of the importance which you've vested into that is not deserved. Only then can you become a silent sage, knowing that all thinking misses the point, that all thinking betrays its promise of finding an answer or a solution to the problem. You think that is actually the great con job of thinking. I don't know if you've ever gone to any of the second-hand car yards in Perth, but they can sell you an old mule for a car. Those con artists are just like the con artists inside your head right now, called thinking. They can sell you anything. Think, 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 and it can convince you of anything. So when you see thinking through Satipatthana, it gets less attractive, it gets less meaningful, and you end up getting more silent. Stand back and watch thoughts. See how silly it is, how useless it is for most of the time, and you become much more silent. But more than that, one of the most important of the mind objects is chetana, will, because that's the other, what I call the two citadels of the self, the knower, that which knows, consciousness, jitta, which is the third of the Satipatthanas, and the last one, chetana, which is included under the fourth, will. What is that which does? After a nice jhana, when the mind is very powerful, very clear, you can watch chetana happen. See what will actually is. Who chooses? When you scratch your face, what caused that? Was it some being, some person, some Ajahn Brahm inside who decided to scratch his nose? Was it someone else who decided to yawn? Was it someone else who decided to turn their head or scratch their cheek? Who did that? With that degree of mindfulness, sustained attention, you can see that even chetana is a complete bubble. There is no one there. The doer is the most important thing to find out, because you get into so much turmoil and guilt by blaming yourself, by which I mean blaming the doer. The simile which I've given before is of the driverless bus. I think I've given a simile already, I just run through it very quickly. Sometimes you get to so much suffering and pain and problems in life, you really want to sort of try and teach yourself, never make the same mistake again. You want to find out who's doing all this, so you can make a much more efficient, wise, skillful doer. So you never make mistakes anymore, you never get into trouble, you always have happiness. You want to control the doer, teach the doer, make the doer do only happiness. You've got to find out what that doer is first of all. This is a simile of sitting in the back of the bus and shouting and complaining about the doer. That's called guilt, anger, ill will. When you finally find where that doer is, Satipatthana, you just watch and see, what's doing this? Who's doing this? Where does Chaitanya will come from? What you discover, much to your surprise but eventual relief, is you find what I call the seat, the driver's seat of the bus, which is you call you. And you have the shock of your life because you find the driver's seat is empty. The bus is going along the road, but there's no one's driving it. What do you do then? You sit back in your seat and you stop complaining. So you don't keep on having all these cravings and ill will and desire, because there's no one to shout at anymore. The doer is not there. Find it is an empty process. Once you see there's no doer, that is the ending of craving. There's no point to it anymore. So these are the four satipatthanas, the four focuses of mindfulness. When you have a beautiful jhana and you focus on those four things, you are undermining the basic illusion which creates suffering in life, the illusion of self. It's hard to get that insight except when the five hindrances are completely overcome. Why? Because we don't want to see non-self. We've got a vested interest in being. In fact, one of the great cravings is the craving to be. Well, we're terrified of not being. If a devil, you know, like in the old movies, a devil came in, a real demon with horns and a tail and everything, and came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, I'll give you $1,000,000 if you give me my soul. My soul. I say, done. At least we get $1,000,000 to build a nun's monastery. The devil won't get anything. I've got no, there's no soul in here. Even if you say that, you know, you've got no soul. Now, that's actually quite a modern comment to make about somebody, isn't it? That's actually quite a put down. Someone said to me, Ajahn Brahm, you've got no soul. I said, you also know? So in our Western society, this goes against the grain, doesn't it? And it goes against the grain of all your conditioning as well. You want to be, you want to exist, you want to experience life. You want to do more things. That's the problem. That creates suffering. So it goes against the grain to see these things. That's why they're hard to see. That's why the Buddha almost gave up teaching. He said, it's just too difficult. People just don't want to hear this sort of stuff. But then he was very smart and said, well, look, instead of like teaching it straight out, why not sort of get people into jhanas first of all? It gets really peaceful, very soft. So their mind will see what's true, whether they want to or not. And then said, just have a look. Have a look at the doer. See if there is anybody there. Have a look at the mind, the knower. See if there is anything there. Have a look at Vedana, pleasure and pain. What's the big deal? Have a look at this body and stop sort of caressing it so much. He just asks you to have a look and see for yourself. The point is, if you do look and see, then you'll see just the great illusion which has caused you so much trouble for so many lifetimes. Samsara, the realm of rebirth, will just unravel and you'll know what the Buddha meant by non-self. That's what the Buddha meant. Once you see that, that's it. Seven lifetimes at most. So if you do the practice according to the instructions, that's what happens. Many people have read the Satipatthana Sutra right at the very end. It says, if you practice like this for 7 days, you become enlightened. And sometimes they practice for 3 months retreats and still don't get anywhere. Why? If you brought a microwave and plugged it in and it didn't work, what would you do? before you took it back to the shop, you'd look at the instructions and see whether you followed the instructions. People do Satipatthana these days and they don't follow the instructions. That's why they don't get enlightened within 7 days. First of all, abandon the five hindrances. Get jhana first of all, and then do Satipatthana. Then you've got a chance within 7 days. Unfortunately, we've only got 2 days left, but we'll see how we go. Okay, I've gone over time again. So, is there any one question about that before we finish off? Ah, okay, come on then. Yeah. Intention is just a reaction, yeah, it is. It's just a causal reaction. Extremely complex. Why you even ask that question? Why is it you always ask the questions? You should have said you've got no choice. It had to be you. It's all your conditioning. So don't feel bad about it. If anyone says, why are you always asking the question? I can't help it. There's actually I saw a study done of sometimes the psychologists do some really neat things. They were doing an experiment to see when choice arose, because putting a few electrodes on the skull, they can measure something called readiness potential. When an action of the body is about to happen, something turns on in the mind, first of all. They can actually measure that. When the mind initiates the action, or rather when the brain initiates the action, sorry. So they were doing this experiment. When the brain initiated the action, they would know immediately. When the action happened, I think they were just flexing their wrist. Whatever you want to flex your wrist, just flex the wrist. And they could see, just before the person flexed the wrist, something sort of happening in the brain. And then they flexed the wrist. They also gave the experimenters a little button. And when they decided, just as they decided to flex the wrist, push the button. And then they flex the wrist. So they're also measuring the time when the experimenters were aware of the will arising. Taking account of reaction times, they found quite clearly, without any doubt, that the readiness potential appeared in the brain first of all. A few microseconds later, the will arose, and then the action happened. What you take to be choice is actually not the initiator of the process, but part of the process. By the time you decide what you think you decide, scratch your face, it's already started. So when you decide to ask that question, it was always already too late. You couldn't stop. You have to decide. That's just part of the process of action. It appears to be the initiator, but it's already been initiated when will arises. Yeah? Great, marvellous. That's straight Buddhism. Don't like that. It's true, that's all you are. And when you come to a retreat, I am reconditioning you. This is a brainwashing retreat, and I make no bones about it. But people don't mind because it's fun. It's also scary sometimes, but then you know it's fun because you get so much fun meditating. And there's a sense that there's actually some truth behind all this. There is truth behind it. This is the way of the arahats. All the enlightened beings realize this is just a bunch of conditions, that's all. Conditions arising, conditions passing away. We think we're in control, and that's the great myth. Even when you go to a supermarket, or you go to the shopping centers in Singapore, or wherever else you go to shop, and you really think that you are immune to all the advertisements, that's the greatest conceit of people in the world. They think other people buy those products because they see the adverts. You think that you're not convinced. You are. That's why people advertise. It's not just stupid people follow those advertisements. Everyone does. but we think we're immune. When we go to that shop, we think we have completely free choice what we're going to buy. We haven't. You've already been conditioned. Scary. Even like politicians know that. That's why they have all these sort of spin doctors and campaigns. They condition you to vote for a certain party. It's not a free election at all. There's no such thing as democracy. It's all conditioned. So there we go. Okay, now don't think too much about it. Just go and meditate. Okay.